Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming today from our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. Today we're going to look at the latest on the role of red meat in your body and how that contributes to heart disease, a brand new study out today from the Cleveland Clinic, and a lot more on health and healing. After all, if we know what's bad for us, we can prevent the conditions that could occur if we consume it. Our goal from now forward, and especially after the new year, is intentional wisdom, intentional knowledge, intentional opening ourselves up to new ideas. We have a lot coming at you. For example, I believe that we should unify everyone in America to say no to putting people in prison because they can't pay a bill. The return of debtors' prisons. My guest in the second part of our program today from Washington, D.C., is Professor Peter Edelman. Now, he is the Karnak Waterhouse Professor of Law and Public Policy at Georgetown University, where he's on the faculty for the Center for Poverty. We're going to talk about how inequality has led to criminalization of the poor in America. We could and should have our yellow vest moment as France is right now. And if you want a rallying call for people, it's for those of us who are not destitute or in need of a place to stay tonight or a meal to eat. We must start to exercise something greater than our own selfish obsessions. We have to think of the spiritual, at the spiritual level, about what about the millions, tens of millions of Americans who are struggling and who will be put in debtors' prisons. So we're going to have that dialogue with him today. And I am going to minimize the other distractions today because I've got so much information to share with you on so many different topics that I think are important. And we always begin with the latest on health and healing. In current studies, the Cleveland Clinic researchers have uncovered new mechanisms that demonstrate why and how regularly eating red meat can increase the risk of heart disease and the role of gut bacteria play in the process. The researchers, an MD, PhD, Stanley Hazen, builds upon previous work showing that an oxide, a gut bacteria byproduct formed during digestion, can lead to the development of cardiovascular disease. And where do you get this gut bacteria? I've said it many times. You get it from eating animal proteins. And that's unfortunate, especially liver and red meats. Well, every time you eat a pizza, you're getting that red meat. Hot dogs, you're getting the red meat. Steaks, you're getting the red meat. So I think that's important. Eat red meat, contribute to heart disease, heart attack and stroke. Go to a healthy plant-based diet and protect yourself from heart attack and stroke. They are diametrically opposite. So why are we eating more meat than ever before in our country's history? Conditioning. And because we become disconnected from cause and effect. Could you imagine that if you had one glass of hard alcohol, immediately within 5 minutes you'd be on the floor in excruciating pain, your liver and kidneys would be shutting down, you'd have to be rushed in for a transplant. One hamburger and you have a heart attack. One cigarette and you have lung cancer. If we had that kind of reality, we wouldn't make bad choices. We would have a cautionary moment. But as a society, there are certainly exceptions. I'm guessing anywhere between 5 to 10% of people really think before they say something, do something, that there's a consequence. If you know the consequence you want, then choose appropriately. That's conscious awareness of the outcome of my choice. So let's start introducing the theme, not just of intentional ignorance, intentional unknowing, so we can have plausible deniability. Who knew that it was dangerous to drive when you were drunk? No one told me. That's intentional ignorance. What about including intentional reverse it? Intentional awareness of cause and effect. Intentional outcome events, meaning I want a good outcome. What choices must I make to have it? We just have to keep repeating this over and over and over till one day it just becomes a normal part of our thinking. And therefore, we start changing old conditioned programmed habits and rituals into more healthy ones. From the Francis Crick Institute at Cambridge University in England comes a study that almost all of our genes are influenced by the foods we eat. This is important because we've left genes and food out of the equation and discussion for decades. So now, we're looking at it a little differently. How can I put this? Clothes may make the person, but his and her diet goes into the genes that make up the person. So we surround ourselves with what is external to our image instead of looking what is internal to our well-being. Good thoughts are like good food. Good energy is the impact of that good food. Now we know from the Francis Crick Institute that food we consume literally affects all of our genetic data. So now, remember I said that good food is good bacteria, bad food, including sugar, meat, is bad bacteria? So our nutrients help with metabolism, and that affects all of our genes. And they act together. So that can affect the behavior of our cells. So literally, by getting on a bad diet, your genes are programmed for bad health. This is an epigenetic, EPI, genetic, GENETIC. This is a modifier, and it can attach to the DNA and turn the gene on or off. So therefore, when I'm helping people and I'm asking them, and I ask everyone this, no matter what their condition, what do you want? What do you want the outcome to be? Well, I'd like to be out of so much pain. Okay, but you've been told you have terminal cancer and you only have weeks to live. This actually happened last night in a counseling session. You just accept that you're going to die. Nothing can be done with cancer. You just don't want to be in as much pain. Yeah. Then that person will die, as their doctors predict, and it'll be from cancer. So then what is the protocol? Is the protocol what will help with the cancer? What will help with the pain? Or where I start, always, with everyone, what will help create a greater desire to live, and therefore the epigenetic DNA will turn on, I want to live. I want a healthier, newer life. I want to start over. Because then you're creating something that's fundamental and foundational. The metabolic network itself can regulate gene activity. Well, if you have a positive attitude, that directly impacts your metabolic network. So, we can reverse disease. We cannot do it. I'm writing a major article on this right now. Present it next week, part one of it. It's going to be rather long. It's probably around 100 pages, but I'll break it into like 10-page sections over a period of time. That the current models we're using, with all the right intention, I'm not questioning people's intent, they want to help people overcome disease, but all the tools they're using are the wrong ones. In fact, many of the tools they're using actually enhance the turnoff of the immune system, the turnoff of the genes to self-repair. So attitude is first. Changing your perception of what you can do is second with the attitude. You can't change your perception if your attitude is wrong. When you change your perception, you change your reality. When you change your reality, you can then choose the diet, choose the friends, choose the work, and choose the environment that you want to be in. Now you take someone with the right attitude. You put them in a healthy, beautiful environment. Watch how they change. It's important. And we don't think enough about it. Also, a new study shows that we should be consuming more green tea. Now, make sure when you do consume green tea, you consume the decaffeinated green tea, because they're not looking at the downside of caffeine. They're looking at the upside of all of its healing nutrients. It's really good to help prevent cancer. It's good for the heart. It's good for blood pressure. It's good for cholesterol. It's good for your metabolism. It's good for diabetes. But if you cannot consume green tea every day, then do the next best thing, and that would be to take green tea capsules, decaffeinated, about 200 milligrams, more or less, per capsule, 2 to 3 times a day, and that will help also. Makes a big difference. Also, according to University of Colorado research, your brain on imagination is a lot like reality. Yes. Imagine a barking dog, or a furry spider, or another perceived threat, and your brain and body respond much like they would if you experienced the real thing. Imagine it repeatedly in a safe environment, and soon your phobia or the brain's response to it subsides. That's the takeaway of a new brain image study led by the University of California and the Icahn School of Medicine researchers, suggesting that imagination can be a powerful tool in helping people with fear and anxiety-related disorders overcome them. So this research confirms that imagination is a neurological reality that can impact our brains and bodies in ways that matter for our well-being. And that's important. That was published in the journal Neuron. So another way of looking at it, a simpler way, is think about what you want to put in your imagination and then focus upon that. There was a story, I'm guessing it goes back 35 years. I tried to get the woman on my radio program, but we couldn't locate her. She was from China, and she'd been a victim of Mao and his wife's Gang of Four, destruction of all of the dynamic energies. They would take artists, intellects, people who were independent thinkers, and they would either kill them or they would put them in re-indoctrination camps. And in some cases, they want to make an example. This woman, who was an artist, they want to make an example. So they tied her to a chair. I believe it was 7 years in solitary confinement where no guard, no one could speak to her. And when she got out, she wrote this beautiful book. And the thought was, how could you write a book of that beauty when you were tortured by, and by the way, the same China mindset still exists today. Don't let anyone be fooled by the good things they're doing. The Communist Party is just as bad as it's ever been. They even make the people they assassinate or kill by their own bullet. In any case, she said, they could restrain my body, but not my imagination. So each day when I awakened, I would create in my mind, with my imagination, what I wanted to do that day. So if I was writing, I would write my imagination. If I was going to go for a walk, I would go for that walk in my imagination. The colors, the sights, the sounds, I would put into my imagination every day while she was awake for seven, I believe it was 7 years. That's how powerful your imagination is. No matter what circumstances your physical reality presents to you, your imagination can exceed it and create a better outcome for you. That's the takeaway message of that Colorado study. And from the University of Vermont, could eating chili peppers actually help you live longer? Research from the University of Vermont indicates that consuming red chili peppers, cayenne peppers among them, not the ghost peppers, but those are really hot. I snuck a tiny piece in one time as a joke to a friend who said he could. In fact, we were down in New Orleans, and I love New Orleans, and the French Quarter is the best. And they were going from shop to shop to shop to try to find the hottest pepper. And they, down in Cajun country, they really like spicy food. I like spicy foods, but not ones that's going to burn your tongue. And the ghost pepper will do that. In any case, I found one, and I took a tiny piece. When I say a tiny piece, I'm talking about a tiny piece off just one end. And I put it in some gumbo. And suddenly I look at George, and he profuse perspiration. He said, damn, this really is hot. And he drank about a gallon of ice water. And he said to the person, how'd this get so hot? And the person didn't know. Well, those chili peppers are really good for you. Not the hottest in the world, but a regular chili pepper, just red chili pepper or a cayenne pepper. So it may not always feel like you're going to live long after you consume one in a spicy meal, but it's those hot peppers are doing a lot of good. Now, this was published in the scientific journal PLOS ONE and involved analyzing data gathered by the National Institutes of Health and the Nutritional Examination Survey. 16,000 people were followed for 23 years, and they were found that the people who ate the most chili peppers or cayenne pepper often were less likely to die than those who did not eat chili peppers. Yeah. And then they looked into it. The more often you eat chili peppers, the less likely you are to die by 33.6% compared to those that didn't eat chili peppers at all. So we know that it speeds up our blood circulation. So it's really good for people. The capsaicin, the active ingredient, gets microcirculation in the brain. So if you have Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS, multiple sclerosis, dementia, you need more cayenne pepper. You can actually buy the capsules. I believe in taking them 2-3 times a day. Always take one before you go to bed at night because that can help prevent a stroke. And many of those strokes happen at night. So it also helps enhance circulation of the heart. It thins the blood. It turns off pain. It's great for anyone with pain. So, but it also, and this is the first time, it keeps you from dying from all sorts of things. And then I read a study from St. Michael's Hospital, which is in Toronto, about people who didn't understand that some dried fruits are actually better with the low glycemic index than bread. So people with diabetes and followers of diets based upon the glycemic index can enjoy dried fruits knowing that they do not cause a blood sugar spike compared to starchy foods like white bread. And that was published in the journal Nutrition and Diabetes. The results of the study also suggest there's potential for food manufacturers to develop low glycemic foods with reformulations that include dried fruit. And that's important. This work was done at the St. Michael's Hospital and the Clinical Nutrition and Risk Factor Modification Center. And which four foods would you imagine had low glycemic compared to other foods that are higher, like almost all your breakfast cereals, potatoes and rice, white rice in particular, and breads? They spike your blood glucose level. They're dangerous, and that means they spike your insulin level. And while the carbohydrates in low glycemic, including beans and lentils, legumes, and most of your whole grains, like barley and oats, they're broken down more slowly. They cause more moderate increase in blood glucose. And it was simple ones, like apricots, dried apricots are an example. And raisins are an example, yeah. And dried peaches and dried pears. And finally, it's been a long time since I've mentioned modified citrus pectin. A new study, however, out of Miami's Children's Hospital and Dharma Biomed shows that modified citrus pectin can inhibit the growth and metastasis of prostate cancer and kill leukemia cells. Now, for the people in this audience who know someone who has prostate cancer or don't want to get it, prostate cancer is the second most common cancer among American men. And the statistics indicate that there are over 2 million prostate cancer survivors currently living in the United States. Generally, it comes after the age of 65, and it's rated as the second most common cause of cancer-related death in American males. And while early detection is important, changing your diet and getting away from meat and estrogen-producing foods and meat stress and being overweight with a pot belly are the three things you can do. And leukemia is another form of cancer that claims many lives each year. And while the overall five-year survival rate has quadrupled since the 1960s, leukemia still kills over 20,000 people annually. So the key is get off meat and alcohol and have more appropriate ways of dealing with stress and get rid of that pot belly. And also, I'm interested in getting the latest study from one of the people that we detoxed. He dropped 88,000 points in his blood sugar, and the oncologist couldn't imagine because there's no medicine could do it. He did it. And now it's gone down further. I'll find out and tell you how much further it goes. Oh, and by the way, University of California at Berkeley, they found that as couples age, humor and tenderness towards one another increases, and that allows for a kind of a mellowing, so people are not as interested in fighting or arguing. That's not everyone, of course, but for those who understand, share a lot more laughter with your partner. Don't be hypercritical. You'll lower your stress hormones, and you'll live a longer life and have a better relationship. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you. Thank you all for joining us. I have a very powerful program this evening on the Progressive Commentary Hour. A lot of the people in this audience are people who care about issues at a deeper level. And I take on the hard issues on the Progressive Commentary Hour. And tonight, we're going to hear from a person who is joining Progressive Radio Network shortly. So is Jimmy Dore and a lot of others in the next two to three weeks. And this is James Corbett. And in my opinion, James Corbett is quite simply one of the best journalists in the history of journalism. And he does the best shows. So he is really interesting. And he's going to take us on a look at the Boer Wars, the Cecil Rhodes family, the concentration camps of the African population in South Africa, the Rothschild Bank who financed this, bringing up through World War I, and what really caused World War I. What were people up to, we have been given, in my belief, the wrong history of the First World War, much like we've been given, even in the PBS special on Vietnam. There are a lot of things I would have added to that that he didn't add. But we each have our own perspective. So you will get the most comprehensive look at the real, not conspiratorial, real people in the Rothschild family, how they work with American people, bankers, policymakers, J.P. Morgan, Warburgs, and how they profit off war. But we never tell that side of the story. We never tell who profits from war. Even right now, where we do not have money for infrastructure, we do not have money to build humane environments for senior citizens who are now homeless. We don't have money to pay for food for 16 million hungry children who are food insecure each day. We have unlimited amounts of money for the military-industrial complex, and we don't question anything that they do. And yet, there was $6 trillion missing in one audit, $21 trillion missing in another audit from university professors who did the audit. No one's held accountable. Nobody cares what happens. Just keep going. So how do we get here? Tonight's show will discuss that. But I'm very disappointed by our body politic. I commend those people going into politics who are idealists, who are populists, who are looking to change. Here's the bad part. The entirety of the body politic at every agency is controlled by a group of very powerful people who select their best and brightest to become the technocrats, to run the FDA, to run the National Institutes of Health, to run the Department of Energy, to run the Treasury. And it's always the people who are the least qualified to make changes that benefit we the people. Now, the two most important powerful positions in our Congress are the head of the Senate and the head of the House, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi in the House. It's one thing to say we'll know what's in a bill when it's passed into law. That's just the dumbest statement I've ever heard. And we don't even ask who writes the bills. Well, special interest group. Like at your state level, it's the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. They write the bills. They meet at exclusive resorts. They sit with your legislator, those that allow themselves to be given this quid pro quo. They're helped in their reelection bids. That legislator goes back into their Congress, whatever it might be. In each state, it's different. And they pass this bill into law. At no time does that lawmaker get up and say, I must be honest, I stayed at a very luxurious place, I had all my expenses paid, I sat with lobbyists from any one of 250 corporations, they handed me this bill, I've now incorporated this bill as if it were my own, I knew nothing about it until I met with these people, it's only going to serve their interest, we are all corrupt, the governor's corrupt, the attorney general, everyone in the state's corrupt, but we all accept that. The people don't care unless there's a scandal. Then the scandal is irrelevant to changing anything. That's who we are. So I'm just being honest up front. Would we still accept it if someone actually had the honesty to say that? No. I believe that every person in any legislative session ever that's currently in office should resign or be forced to resign if they met with an outside force because they've corrupted the system because they're themselves corrupt. But this is normal business in Washington at every level. So now imagine you're the young idealist. You're Jimmy Stewart. Mr. Smith goes to Washington. You're the person who's got some ideals. You want to change the system. Systems don't change ever. They have to collapse like the Roman Empire. I'll get to that on another program. But no paradigm changes. Not one, not a single one. There's no reforming them unless they control the outcome, and it's always to their betterment that they do it, the people in control. Here's someone unguarded, Nancy Pelosi. You're going to see her. It's 30 seconds long. Listen carefully what she says. Listen carefully.
If you want to talk politics, you call it the wrap-up smear. You smear somebody with falsehoods and all the rest, and then you merchandise it. And then you write it, and they'll say, see, it's reported in the press that this, 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 and this. So they have that validation that the press reported the smear, and then it's called the wrap-up smear. Now I'm going to merchandise the press's report on the smear that we made. And it's a tactic, and it's self-evident.
Yeah. Remember Judith Miller, the New York Times? Here's what I know from my contacts. Miller was given a source called Curveball. Curveball had already been interviewed by people in the CIA and also, I believe it was German intelligence and the Mossad. He had been discredited. He was not legitimate. But Dick Cheney's office and Scooter Libby, the head of his office, used Curveball and then used Judith Miller to get the story in the New York Times. All, you know, weapons of mass destruction. So now that it's in the New York Times, Dick Cheney gets up and says, it's in the New York Times. That's exactly what she's talking about. Every one of the fools, the mindless idiots in the Bush administration, and I you will never hear me call George Bush Jr. a mindless idiot, because I would not be that presumptive to assume that he had a brain in his head to have a mind. I've never seen people this incompetent. But that's what they did. Every one of them would get they would plant a story, the story would be reported, then they would use the reported story to validate their decision. Colin Powell, the UN, they all did it. They do it every day. We see it right now. In everything in body politic, and that's why I have no respect for body politic. I have no respect. I would never degrade myself. I would never, ever in my life lower my standards by voting for any of these politicians who are part of that political mix. An independent who has ideals and can show that they're going to resist that, even if it means they will have no power. I would rather vote for someone as an independent who has no power but goes to Washington, raises hell, and exposes their colleagues and the corruption. That's a person I could support. All the rest, all corrupt. I'm going to run through some ideas now of things we don't hear about in the media before we go to our guest. And we're going to go to our guest in just a few minutes that I believe that you should be aware of. First up, this is from Bandera and David Carpenter from The Lancet, the British medical journal, The Lancet. Quote, planetary electromagnetic pollution. It is time to assess its impact. For the first time, orthodox mainstream medical science is saying all this electromagnetic pulses all over the world, these could present a real danger. Well, yes, they do present a danger. We already know it. You already know it. Now at least they're going to look into it. This is from Common Dreams. As demand for urgent transformation intensified, new study shows hotter planet making extreme weather deadlier. Quote, hurricanes and wildfires in bleaching and drought, bleaching means the coral reef, they're happening to us right now, and we face new and challenging risks of how they're going to affect us in the future. And here's what is understated. I filmed in the last year at least 14 climatologists who say, no one's being honest with you. It's happening right now. And they're afraid to tell the truth because of what it would mean for industries, their profits, people relocating. This is from Kate Arnoff of The Intercept. Unhinged growth, domestic product growth could actually destroy the economy, economists find. Okay? This is about global warming and what's happening to the world. if we do not pay attention to how we can de-accelerate gross domestic product as the only metric of showing that a country is viable, how much money did you make? How many goods did you manufacture or sell? What services are you selling? We have to grow more next year. That's the only way that people are accounting for the type of capitalism we use. So let me just show you why this is the wrong way to look at it. The three countries in the world that create the most pollution, number one is China. Number two is the United States. Number three is India. Together, they represent 53% of all global warming pollution. All right? China has got the most solar panel manufactured in the world, 80%, 500% more than the United States, the most wind turbines. So when you see something about China, you see this development in green energies. But all of their green energies represent only 20% of their total utilization of energy. They're still the world's leader in coal plants and pollution. But what's bad is that you haven't been told, and I'll be the first to tell you this, China is creating the largest city. How big? Bigger than the largest city now, which is Tokyo, which is 40 million people. China has developed a unique concept with the latest technology, including artificial intelligence, where three districts are being all pulled into one area, one city larger than the Netherlands. It'll have more people than the European Union and twice as many as living in the United States. Just the first of these cities will have 140 million to 160 million people. That's just one part of one city. And they're all connected by the fastest new rails, and all the cities will be hubs of manufacturing as well as people living. Now, right now, with neck and neck with India, with about 1.3 billion people, they're light years ahead of India, where India still has 700 million people don't have running water or toilets. China has moved 800 million of its citizens into cities. This new plan would move 95% of all the people in China into cities. China has tiny little farms, smallest farms of any developed country. The average farm is only 2.5 acres. That's tiny. So now they have to go to industrial farming, but they don't have the land to do it and the weather to sustain it. So they're going to the Amazon. So now the Amazon, the lungs of the planet, are being deforested so they can grow genetically engineered soybeans to take back to China to feed to the pigs and the chickens and the beef so that they can have, and they have, 300% increase in eating animals in China. The trouble is the United States is also eating more meat this year than at ever any time in its history, and India is right behind us. So if three countries alone represent over 53% of all global warming, then what do they also have in common? Now you have the biggest city that will be in world history. In fact, it'll be bigger than the population of Europe. And that's one city. Do you have any idea how much energy will be created in order to manufacture the products and the factories and everything that'll be there? It'll easily take us from 1.6 degrees up to over 2 degrees, which is the end, beginning of the end stage of societies as we know it in global warming. They alone will do that. Now throw in India and the United States. So where you will have some people talk about, Barack Obama was great about talking about everything, did nothing. You'll have talking, you won't have actual massive Marshall style change, because gross domestic product is what drives the capitalist engines in our country. So we won't look at getting people to buy less stuff. We're increasing the stuff people are buying. And the most important class of people buying stuff is not the average person. It is the 151 million professional class and their families, the scientists, lawyers, doctors, engineers, architects. And they're about career and making money and lifestyle. And they're buying more and more, and they're in more debt than ever before. And they're not going to stop. So if the policymakers and opinion leaders are not going to deaccelerate, if the politician's not going to deaccelerate, if our economists are not going to suggest another plan of minimalizing our expenditures, and China is rapidly growing, they want to be number one, not number two, and India's right behind them, then exactly how are we supposed to hold global warming and environmental degradation down? And that's something that we don't talk about, and we should. We're going to go over to my guest who is standing by, and I gave you his background a few moments ago. And I'd like to welcome to our program Professor Peter Edelman. He is also, by the way, recent book is Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Early in America's history, debtor prisons were imported from Western Europe, where it served as a means to incarcerate people, usually the poor, and place them in confined work environments where they would be used as labor until their debts were paid. But in the mid-19th century, the U.S. federal government ruled it was barbaric, and it was left to the states whether debtor prisons would be used or not. And unfortunately, some states still have it on their books. And in recent years, we've seen a rapid increase in people being imprisoned because they are simply unable to pay off debts or interest on loans or court fees or even fines for very minor violations such as a traffic ticket, parking in the wrong place, or letting your meter expire. Now, you cite several reasons. I read your article, by the way. I really appreciated how it became a crime to be poor in America in The Guardian. And so now, many of the examples of impoverished people sitting in prisons for being unable to pay a single simple fine are, in my estimation, unconscionable. Or arresting and fining homeless people simply for being homeless with nowhere to go. And you estimate the United States has about 500,000 people in jails for the reason of being poor. And one example of this eroding condition of our legal and social system is Ferguson, Missouri. So please take your time and give us your view on the state of our debtors' prisons today. And where do you foresee this trend heading? And is it possible that a dynamic leader, like a president of the United States, if they chose, or members of Congress, if they chose, or members of the American population, if they chose, much like the Yellow Jackets in France, could make this an issue and galvanize all of our attention to it so we can embarrass ourselves, if nothing else, into stopping what is simply reprehensible and unconscionable behavior? The forum is yours.
Well, thank you. You know, this is really a national problem. That's the first thing that we have to understand here, and I think most people don't know this. They know that we have mass incarceration. I think everybody knows that. We have people who have been prosecuted on a variety of crimes that shouldn't be crimes, or for sentences that are much too long, and disproportionately people of color, African American, Latino, Native American, and that's been with us particularly since about the 1970s, people are pushing back right now. This particular president and Congress may before the end of the year may make some reform on sentencing on the federal side. What was going on starting really about during the Reagan period, when people started talking about we're paying too much taxes, and I mean, as you know, and we all know, we've had an anti-tax rebellion for 30-plus years. And one of the things that happened to get some money to run courts and really whole governments or parts of governments that other than the courts, they started, just in general, starting users' fees, right? One way or another, we pay things for things that we didn't used to. Some people even talk about these ideas of being in jail or in prison. I've heard people say that those are just user fees. Crazy. This was going along, and I think people who were victims of it, as you talked about, people who couldn't pay the fine and these irrelevant fees that were tacked on for things that had nothing to do whatever they had done, and they owed $500,000, a combination of the fine and the fee, and they can't pay, and they ended up in jail. In fact, what the other thing that started, and which is really the bigger thing, the kind of thing that's been dramatic and people became somewhat aware of it, was what you were talking about, people who didn't have a permit to burn the leaves in their backyard, and they get I'm telling you actually a particular story, they end up in jail because they can't pay the money. The thing that happens, even bigger than these kinds of awful things like that, is taking away people's driver's licenses, suspending them, which takes place in 43 states. And I'm not talking about somebody who was out drunk. I'm talking about things that had nothing to do with the car at all, and are mostly about taking away people's driver's licenses because they owe money, a court debt, for something sometimes related to the auto, but very often not. So the combination of all of these things, we're talking about 10 million people in the country who owe money on these things, $50 billion, and 7 million of those 10 million are people who have had their driver's license taken away. There are a lot of places that use jails, and that's particularly awful. But there are a lot of places where they just squeeze people by. When you have your car license, your auto license taken away, it's just really hard not to drive your car. Particularly lower income people, they don't have any choices, and they have to get to work, and they get taking the child to school or whatever it is, so they get arrested again, and they owe more and more, and then the state comes at them and takes away a piece of their wage, their paycheck, takes care of their refund under the state incomes. So this is big money. This is big business. What this is about is to squeeze people to get money to run their governments. That's what we discovered. And when we discovered it, it was the reason we discovered it, even though it was going on all over the country. We were just there were certainly the victims themselves knew, and people in the court systems knew, and some journalists talked about it. But the people were really not aware of the fact that this was going on in almost every part of the country. Well, came Ferguson, Missouri, and the murder, the killing of Michael Brown, and as a, along with that, the Department of Justice came along to take a look at what was going on down there, and they discovered that that little town in St. Louis County was running its government in exactly the way that I said. They were just arresting their own people over and over again, and getting money that, because they weren't, they don't have a tax system. They did these things, and they were putting people in jail when they couldn't pay. And among other things, it was, it made no sense, because if you put somebody in jail, it costs money to put them there. And even if you charge those fees, as they do, to pay, they can get it from some people. But if you don't have the money, you don't have the money. And it's just, the whole thing makes no sense, except it's mean. And disproportionately, it's people of color who get hit on all of this. So what do we do about it? You asked what we should be doing, a different president, et cetera. This is, there is room for, and there was when President Obama was president, and we had a Department of Justice that cared about these things, and they were giving guidance to for states. They didn't have to follow them, but to strongly suggest them. That's gone away. But really, the change on these things, and it's both about the fines and fees and also the money bail that goes along with it, because one of the things that's done on these things is the person is thrown into jail because they this is before they've even been brought to trial. Sometimes it's for more serious crimes, but in any case, it's all terrible for low-income people. I mean, just to give you on that, you have 700,000 people on any given day in jails around the country, and 450,000 of those people are not guilty of anything. They're waiting for a trial. They're there because they could not come up with the bail. In many cases, these are things that should not be a matter of bail at all, because they're all people who have, they're not scary for anybody, and indeed they come back. We know that we have the evidence that come back for trial. So it's just, what happens is the person is stuck there. And he or she, mostly men, but some women, the only way they're going to get out of there, because they don't have the money for the bail, is they go to the judge and they say, I'm pleading guilty, even though they're not. And that way they get out. But they get, with that, a payment plan, and then they get thrown back in again because they have all of these fees that mount and mount and mount. And it's part of the money bail is part of the whole system of squeezing people to get this money. Now, we're beginning to see, and I can go into this in more detail, but just to make it clear, we are getting more attention to this from a journalistic point of view. We're seeing more people here and there elected as prosecutors who are against this. So this is happening in Philadelphia and in Dallas, and kind of a new kind of prosecutor who cares about doing all these things. And there are a number of public defender lawyers who are getting winning cases around the country to get decisions that these kinds of things are unconstitutional. Some of the judges, some of the places, they're doing things, changing with legislation locally, sometimes because the litigation made them, sometimes because they see that what they were doing was wrong. What we need to go with, and I can go into more detail about where there's been terrific wins on money bail, on some of these other things, but we need the people. As you said, we need people to know this is a problem, and they need to understand that it is hurting people by the millions in the country. the consequence of that, with better politics, because people pushed on it and did protest and did say this is very, very serious and we're not doing what we should. And that's the step that we really haven't done. If you ask people around the country, they certainly know about mass incarceration, but you ask about the fines and fees, and they might know a story or an experience they had themselves or somebody in the family and so on. But people don't realize that these are national problems, the fines and fees and the money bail. Getting more public, certainly more public attention on the money bail now, and that's a very good thing.
I appreciate you sharing these insights with us. We're up to the end of our program. There's more information. I recommend people read the article, How It Became a Crime to Be Poor in America, by my guest, Professor Peter Edelman. It's in the current Guardian, or it was in the November 17th Guardian, and we're posting it, and also his newest book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. And I would certainly support your last statement that we need people to make this an issue, not just be aware of it, but to make it an issue. But they can't make it an issue if they're not aware of it. And the fact that we had the majority of SWAT team raids last year and the year before were to deliver notices or collect money or to get people who had outstanding debts. They weren't meant to be debt collectors. You know, you don't have people breaking in doors to collect debt. But we actually have the stories. We have some of those in my new documentary, Friend, Can You Spare a Dime, dealing with poverty. And I'm very concerned about it. And also, if we took the profit and privatization out of the criminal justice system, because now one school district had people who owed money, kids who owed money for lunch programs, where they came to school and didn't have money to buy a meal. So you give them some credit. Now they've hired a debt collection agency to go after those families whose kids came to school too poor to afford the lunch. And you know that they're going to charge them hundreds of percents in compounding interest. And that's what they do. Payday loans, no better. Rolling it over to you, 1,000%. And if you look, without exception, Democrat and Republicans are equally guilty of taking money from these corporations like the private prison corporations. They take the money, then they stay silent when these injustices occur. So we've got to stop this money going into the political system in effect that then causes the system to be so insensitive to human needs. The idea that you would take a person who's so poor they're sleeping on a street, the cops would then give them a ticket. And if they didn't appear in court, compounding interest go in. So a person that couldn't afford a meal now owes $500. That's how corrupt our system is. I do not accept any excuse for that, sir. That is reprehensible. Shame on the judges. Shame on the prosecutors. Shame on your legislators. Shame on the presidents, all of them, especially Barack Obama. Shame on everybody. Everybody deserves to be shamed because everybody should be aware of this and they're not. I'm very happy, however, that you have brought this to our attention in such a way that it forces us to look in a mirror to a very ugly returning picture of ourselves. Thank you very much for your courageous work.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow, and you don't want to miss tonight's 7 o'clock PRN.FM show.